Chapter 17. Wendy Takes a Fall. 1. The situation would have resolved itself in some way or other, no matter what happened. Thad was sure of that. George Stark wasn't simply going to go away. But Thad came to feel, and not without justification, that Wendy's tumble from the stairs 2 days after Stark called him at Dave's Market set just what course the situation would take for good and all. The most important result was that it finally showed him a course of action. He had spent those 2 days in a sort of breathless lull. He found it difficult to follow even the most simple-minded TV program, impossible to read, and the idea of writing seemed roughly akin to the idea of faster-than-light travel. Mostly he wandered from one room to the next, sitting for a few moments and then moving on again. He got under Liz's feet and on her nerves. She wasn't sharp with him about it, although he guessed she had to bite her tongue on more than one occasion to keep from giving him the verbal equivalent of a paper cut. Twice he set out to tell her about the second call from Stark, the one where Foxy George had told him exactly what was on his mind, secure in the knowledge that the line wasn't tapped and they were speaking privately. On both occasions he had stopped, aware that he could do nothing but upset her more. And twice he had found himself up in his study, actually holding one of those damned barrel pencils he had promised never to use again, and looking at a fresh cellophane-wrapped pile of the notebooks Stark had used to write his novels. "You got an idea, the one about the wedding and the armored car score." And that was true. Thad even had a title, a good one, Steel Machine. Something else was true, too. Part of him really wanted to write it. That itch was there, like that one place on your back you can't quite reach when you need to scratch. George would scratch it for you. Oh, yes. George would be happy to scratch it for him. But something would happen to him, because things had changed now, hadn't they? What exactly would that thing be? He didn't know, perhaps couldn't know, but a frightening image kept recurring to him. It was from that charming, racist children's tale of yore, Little Black Sambo. When Black Sambo climbed the tree and the tigers couldn't get him, they became so angry that they bit each other's tails and raced faster and faster around the tree until they turned into butter. Sambo gathered the butter up in a crock and took it home to his mother. George the Alchemist, Thad had mused, sitting in his study and tapping an unsharpened barrel black beauty against the edge of the desk. Straw into gold, tigers into butter, books into bestsellers, and Thad into... what? He didn't know. He was afraid to know. But he would be gone. Thad would be gone. He was sure of that. There might be somebody living here who looked like him, but behind that Thad Beaumont face there would be another mind. A sick, brilliant mind. He thought the new Thad Beaumont would be a good deal less clumsy, and a good deal more dangerous. Liz and the babies? Would Stark leave them alone if he did make it into the driver's seat? Not him. He had considered running as well, packing Liz and the twins into the Suburban and just going. But what good would that do? What good, when foxy old George could look out through dumb old Thad's eyes? It wouldn't matter if they ran to the end of the earth. They would get there, look around, and see George Stark mushing after them behind a team of huskies, his straight razor in his hand. He considered, and even more rapidly and decisively, dismissed the idea of calling Alan Pangborn. Alan had told them where Dr. Pritchard was, and his decision not to try to get a message through to the neurosurgeon, to wait until Pritchard and his wife returned from their camping trip, told Thad all he needed to know about what Alan believed, and, more important, what he did not believe. If he told Alan about the call he'd received in Dave's, Alan would think he was making it up. Even if Rosalie confirmed the fact that he had received a call from someone at the market, Alan would go on not believing. He and all the other police officers who had invited themselves to this particular party had a big investment in not believing. So the days passed slowly, and they were a kind of white time. Just after noon on the second day, Thad jotted, "I feel as if I'm in a mental version of the horse latitudes," in his journal. It was the only entry he had made in a week, and he began to wonder if he would ever make another one. His new novel, The Golden Dog, was sitting dead in the water. That, he supposed, went almost without saying. It was very hard to make up stories when you were afraid a bad man, a very bad man, was going to show up and slaughter your whole family before starting in on you. The only time he could recall being at such a loss with himself had been in the weeks after he had quit drinking, after he'd pulled the plug on the booze bath he'd wallowed in following Liz's miscarriage and before Stark appeared. Then, as now, there had been the feeling that there was a problem, but it was as unapproachable as one of those water mirages you see at the end of a flat stretch of highway on a hot afternoon. The harder he ran toward the problem, wanting to attack it with both hands, dismantle it, destroy it, the faster it receded, until he was finally left, panting and breathless, with that bogus ripple of water still mocking him at the horizon. These nights he slept badly, and dreamed George Stark was showing him his own deserted house. A house where things exploded when he touched them, and where, in the last room, the corpses of his wife and Frederick Clausen were waiting. But the moment he got there, all the birds would begin to fly, exploding upward from trees and telephone lines and electricity poles. Thousands of them, millions of them. So many that they blotted out the sun. Until Wendy fell on the stairs, he felt very much like fools stuffing himself. Just waiting for the right murderous somebody to come along, tuck a napkin into his collar, pick up his fork, and begin to eat. 2. The twins had been crawling for some time, and for the last month or so they had been pulling themselves up to a standing position with the aid of the nearest stable, or in some cases unstable, object. A chair leg was good, as was the coffee table, but even an empty cardboard carton would serve, at least until the twin in question put too much weight on it and it crumpled inward or turned turtle. Babies are capable of getting themselves into divine messes at any age, but at the age of 8 months, when crawling has served its purpose and walking has not quite been learned, they are clearly in the golden age of mess-making. Liz had set them out on the floor to play in a bright patch of sun around 4:45 in the afternoon. After 10 minutes or so of confident crawling and shaky standing, the latter accompanied by lusty crows of accomplishment to their parents and to each other, William pulled himself up on the edge of the coffee table. He glanced around and made several imperious gestures with his right arm. These gestures reminded Thad of old news films showing Il Duce addressing his constituency from his balcony. Then William seized his mother's teacup and managed to pour the lees all over himself before toppling backward onto his bottom. The tea was fortunately cold, but William held onto the cup and managed to wrap it against his mouth smartly enough to make his lower lip bleed a little. He began to wail. Wendy promptly joined in. Liz picked him up, examined him, rolled her eyes at Thad, and took him upstairs to soothe him and then clean him up. "Keep an eye on the princess," she said as she went. "I will," Thad said. But he had discovered, and would shortly rediscover, that in the golden age of mess-making, such promises often amount to little. William had managed to snatch Liz's teacup from under her very nose, and Thad saw that Wendy was going to fall from the third stair riser just a moment too late to save her the tumble. He had been looking at a news magazine, not reading it but thumbing idly through it, glancing every now and then at a picture. When he was finished, he went over to the large knitting basket by the fireplace, which served as a sloppy sort of magazine rack, to put it back and get another. Wendy was crawling across the floor, her tears forgotten before they were entirely dry on her chubby cheeks. She was making the breathy little room, room, room sound both of them uttered when crawling, a sound that sometimes made Thad wonder if they associated all movement with the cars and trucks they saw on TV. He squatted, put the magazine on top of the pile in the basket, and thumbed through the others, finally selecting a month-old Harper's for no particular reason. It occurred to him that he was behaving quite a bit like a man in a dentist's office waiting for a tooth extraction. He turned around, and Wendy was on the stairs. She had crawled up to the third one and was now rising shakily to her feet, holding onto one of the spindles which ran between the rail of the banister and the floor. As he looked at her, she spied him and gave a particularly grandiloquent arm gesture and a grin. The sweep of her arm sent her chubby body swaying forward over the short drop. "Jesus," he said under his breath. And as he rose to his feet, knees popping dryly, he saw her take a step forward and let go of the spindle. "Wendy, don't do that!" He nearly leaped across the room and almost made it. But he was a clumsy man, and one of his feet caught on the leg of the armchair. It fell over, and Thad went sprawling. Wendy fell outward and forward with a startled little squawk. Her body turned slightly in midair. He grabbed for her from his knees, trying to make a saving catch, and missed by a good 2 feet. Her right leg struck the first stair riser, and her head struck the carpeted floor of the living room with a muffled thud. She screamed, and he had time to think how terrifying a baby's cry of pain is, and then he had swept her into his arms. Overhead, Liz called out, "Thad?" in a startled voice, and he heard the thump-thump of her slippered feet running down the hall. Wendy was trying to cry. Her first yell of pain had expelled all but the tidal air from her lungs, and now came the paralyzing, eternal moment when she struggled to unlock her chest and draw in breath for the next whoop. It would bludgeon the eardrums when it finally came. If it came. He held her, looking anxiously into her twisted, blood-engorged face. It had gone a color which was almost puce, except for the red mark like a very large comma on her forehead. God, what if she passes out? What if she strangles to death, unable to pull in breath and utter the cry locked in her flat little lungs? "Cry, damn it!" he shouted down at her. God, her purple face, her bulging, stricken eyes. "Cry!" "Thad!" Liz sounded very scared now, but she also seemed very distant. In those few eternal seconds between Wendy's first cry and her struggle to free the second one and go on breathing, George Stark was driven totally out of Thad's mind for the first time in the last 8 days. Wendy drew in a great convulsive breath and began to whoop. Thad, trembling with relief, hugged her to his shoulder and began to stroke her back gently, making shushing sounds. Liz came pounding downstairs, a struggling William clasped against her side like a small bag of grain.
"What happened? Thad, is she all right?"
"Yes, she took a tumble from the third stair up. She's fine now. Once she started crying, at first it was like she just locked up." He laughed shakily and traded Wendy for William, who was now bellowing in sympathetic harmony with his sister.
"Weren't you watching her?" Liz asked reproachfully.
She was automatically swinging her body back and forth at the hips, rocking Wendy, trying to soothe her.
"Yes? No. I went over to get a magazine. Next thing I knew, she was on the stairs. It was like Will in the teacup. They're just so damned eely.
Is her head all right, do you think? She hit it on the carpet, but she hit hard." Liz held Wendy at arm's length for a moment, looked at the red mark, then kissed it gently. Wendy's sobs were already beginning to diminish in volume.
"I think it's okay. She'll have a bump for a day or two, that's all. Thank God for the carpet. I didn't mean to jump on you, Thad. I know how quick they are. I feel like I'm going to have my period, only it's all the time now."
Wendy's sobs were winding down to sniffles. Accordingly, William also began to dry up. He reached out a chubby arm and snatched at his sister's white cotton t-shirt. She looked around. He cooed, then babbled at her. To Thad, their babbling always sounded a little eerie, like a foreign language which had been speeded up just enough so you couldn't quite tell which one it was, let alone understand it. Wendy smiled at her brother, although her eyes were still streaming tears and her cheeks were wet with them. She cooed and babbled in reply. For a moment, it was as if they were holding a conversation in their own private world, the world of twins. Wendy reached out and caressed William's shoulder. They looked at each other and went on cooing.
"Are you all right, sweet one?"
"Yes, I hurt myself, dear William, but not badly."
"Will you want to stay home from the Stadleys' dinner party, dear heart?"
"I should think not, although you are very thoughtful to ask."
"Are you quite sure, my dear Wendy?"
"Yes, darling William. No damage has been done, although I greatly fear I have shit in my diapers."
"Oh, sweetheart, how tiresome."
Thad smiled a little, then looked at Wendy's leg. "That's going to bruise," he said. "In fact, it looks like it's started already." Liz offered him a little smile.
"It will heal," she said. "And it won't be the last."
Thad leaned forward and kissed the tip of Wendy's nose, thinking how fast and how furiously these storms blew in. Not 3 minutes ago, he had been afraid she might die from lack of oxygen. And how fast they blew back out again.
"No," he agreed. "God willing, it won't be the last."
3. By the time the twins got up from their late naps at 7 that evening, the bruise on Wendy's upper thigh had turned a dark purple. It had an odd and distinctive mushroom shape.
"Thad,"
Liz said from the other changing table, "look at this." Thad had removed Wendy's nap diaper, slightly dewy but not really wet, and dropped it into the diaper bucket marked hers. He carried his naked daughter over to his son's changing table to see what Liz wanted him to see. He looked down at William, and his eyes widened.
"What do you think?"
she asked quietly.
"Is that weird or what?"
Thad looked down at William for a long time. "Yeah," he said at last. "That's pretty weird." She was holding her wriggling son on the changing table with a hand on his chest. Now she looked sharply around at Thad.
"Are you okay?"
"Yes," Thad said. He was surprised at how calm he sounded to himself. A large white light seemed to have gone off, not in front of his eyes like a flash gun, but behind them. Suddenly, he thought he understood about the birds, a little, and what the next step should be. Just looking down at his son and seeing the bruise on his leg, identical in shape, color, and location to the one on Wendy's leg, had made him understand that. When Will had grabbed Liz's teacup and upended it all over himself, he had sat down hard on his butt. So far as Thad knew, William hadn't done anything to his leg at all. Yet there it was, a sympathetic bruise on the upper thigh of his right leg, a bruise which was almost mushroom-shaped.
"You sure you're okay?" Liz persisted.
"They share their bruises, too," he said, looking down at William's leg.
"Thad?"
"I'm fine," he said, and brushed her cheek with his lips. "Let's get psycho and somatic dressed. What do you say?" Liz burst out laughing.
"Thad, you're crazy," she said.
He smiled at her. It was a slightly peculiar, slightly distant smile.
"Yeah," he said. "Crazy like a fox."
He took Wendy back to her changing table and began to diaper her.